Dear Dhamma friends, today also we are going to start the question and answer session. We have 1.5 hours and we'll start with already written questions, and you may present the question. Once that is finished, we'll see the opportunity for the audience to raise questions then and there.
Bhante, the first question is, what is the mind? Why is it so hard to control?
So that is not easy to answer, but nothing we can do away with the mind. And the Buddha gave a kind of an epithet. He says, mind is a magician in a crossroad, and he can make whatever it likes. So we get amused by the magicians, but we don't know everything is a magic, everything is a dream, everything is a mirage. So as far as we entertain it, we are under the spell of the magician. So the Buddha asks us to observe the magic. Knowing it is made by a magician, then you may comprehend partly what must be your attitude towards the mind, rather than entertaining or pleasure principle. So therefore, mind is something you have to understand, and it's the most trickiest thing on the earth to understand. Just simply take it as a mind is a magician.
Next question. How do you deal with impatience, restlessness, boredom, sleepiness during meditation?
So if you can give me a little account how the boredom sets in, how the lethargic nature sets in with respect to your primary object, or is it in your walking meditation or is it in a sitting meditation, and what is your mindfulness, what is your primary object, like basic things, then it will be easier for me to give certain amount of guidance. Without that, mind will be an assumed one, assumption, and may mislead it. So therefore, the person who has written the question has to give, whether it is in the walking meditation or sitting meditation, what is the primary object, how and when this boredom sets in. You may use the mic, please.
During the sitting meditation, I guess, because in the past I've only meditated for about 20 to 30 minutes, so at that stage I think it becomes sort of restless or sleepy or boredom.
So once you sit, once you start the sitting meditation, after how many minutes, in general sense, does this boredom and monotony sets in?
Maybe 20 minutes.
Till that, before this boredom or monotony or lethargic nature comes, were you basically with the primary object, with the breath?
Yes.
So, right from the beginning to the breath, once it is going to end up with this lethargic nature, was there any kind of a evolution or changes or metamorphosis of the breath? You can see when you are keeping 10 minutes rather face to face with the breath, what are the kind of changes with respect to time have you ever observed? One thing is you become bored. After a while, gradually it has become bored, and it has become overwhelming, so you can't control it. So before going to that, any kind of characteristics, any kind of a form, any kind of a shapes, what you see as primary object?
Just that it's harder to notice the breath.
So that means that you are not sure you are with face to face with the breath. So, okay. Now you, at the beginning you mentioned you are in sitting. How, when you are sitting comfortably and close your eyes, how do you know whether you are sitting or standing?
The touching points on the ground and that you are not moving.
So the understanding that is the shape of your body and the touching point, do you consider it as an achievement in the meditation, or the touching point appear like a cumbersome difficulty or unpleasant thing?
It becomes unpleasant after a while.
Yeah. So that is the starting point, starting attitude. Whenever you become mindful, kind of a irritation comes into being. Many people do not understand, I mean, they are not got prepared, so therefore whatever arising appear, bored, irritation. That is the first and foremost sign you are mindful. You get the point?
Yeah.
How do you understand that, what I am going to explain, how do you know, or how do you relate, that when and where you are mindful on the body, you see irritating nature of the body. Touching points, pressure points, and everything. So if you consider this to get rid of this irritation, you will get rid of, well, the mindfulness. So therefore, that must be the first and foremost approach. That means when and where mindfulness sets in, the first sign is you feel kind of irritation. When and where we are not mindful, in the past, future, other people, other places, delightful. When and where it come and be aware, hear things as they are, under your very nose, they are not pleasant. So therefore, that is one thing you have to go prepared, but it is too much for a beginner. So let the beginner to practice, and let he or she come out with some of the results and let him or her to understand these are the thing, these are not the thing you expected. You expected something magical, something delightful, but instead you see just irritating pressure points. And on top of that, if you try to see the breath, even the breath appears, it is not pleasant. It is not something enriching you. It is not giving any thrills and frills. So therefore, if your mind is always searching for something pleasurable with the pleasure principle, so but what the Buddha is presenting is neutral thing. So therefore, the person who is searching for pleasure, whenever a neutral thing come across repeatedly, naturally it appear boring. Naturally it appear irritation. So imagine your attitude is such. When the irritation happens, you understand that is a sign of mindfulness, then you are progressing. Get the point? Can you put into words your words? How can you explain?
So, if you're first focusing on a breathing, but then you notice that you're feeling restless or impatient, you can notice that you're feeling restless or annoyed or something. And then maybe once you notice, you can go back to the breathing.
So the clear point is, when and where you observe mindfully, what you observed is not always pleasant.
Yeah.
It is somewhat irritating. Because mind is always work with the pleasure principle. But the Buddha suggests or give as a primary objective is a neutral one. So, in order to keep that neutral one face-to-face for a longer time, you must have that attitude, that understanding, that outlook, that irritation is a first and foremost sign of the mindfulness. And that irritation, if you misunderstand, leading to boredom. If you misunderstand, leading to monotony. If you misunderstand, leading to sleepiness. If you misunderstand, it's leading to doubts. It's a misunderstanding, it's leading to fearfulness, uncertainty. So that is to have the correct perspective, correct view, only the discussion is the tool we have. So therefore you have to clearly express what you see, have to clearly express your attitude, and must not be with the stereotype mind or premeditated ideas, but when you openly discuss, one day your mind will be prepared, mind will be ready to see when and where mindfulness sets in, or when and where mind become here and aware, the irritation is a kind of associating atmosphere. So therefore, next time, if you understand the thing that we have revealed, next time, go prepared. Whenever the boredom sets in, whenever the mindfulness, the monotony sets in, doubt sets in, see, try to see it is a, it's a product of mindfulness. Endowment of mindfulness. So therefore, don't get eccentric, don't try to rid of that, but instead, try to be vigilant, understand this boredom, this monotony is a result of mindfulness. Can I have another thought moment of mindfulness, another thought moment of mindfulness? So that means then the boredom will appear like a good omen if you see in the correct perspective. So most difficult thing is to convince, to tell someone, because no one will happy to accept it. Everyone wants to have the gladness, happiness, frills and thrills in the mindfulness. So such people utterly, desperately go away from meditation. So therefore, don't try to convince people for meditation. It's a losing fight. It's not a profitable business. But if you get the correct perspective, then only you start the journey to see things as they are. Otherwise, you can be carried away with the this and that lovable thing and pleasurable thing and all the kind of thing. It will take you for a ride. Ultimately, you are the one suffer. You are the one misuse your time. So therefore, do meditate. Do mind, be mindful when and where mind is strong. Mind is prepared. That preparedness is the one we earn in our meditation. And we have to earn the same thing in walking meditation, same thing in day-to-day activities here, same thing at back at home. So ultimately you know this boredom is a kind of a face value, understand. And then the moment you accept it, moment you prepare with your outlook or view, then that barrier is removed. Then you can see a far sight. Whenever boredom happens, see whether it is accompanied by the mindfulness. If the boredom is accompanied by mindfulness, it's a clear sign you are on the correct path.
Next question. How do you deal with intense thoughts and emotions which arise during sitting meditation?
They are, of course, not easy for a beginner, not that you it is cut off from your mindfulness the meditation, but at the beginning you have to understand whenever such a big emotional kind of thing happens, you just escape them, avoid them, and you try to develop mindfulness with the materiality which can be verifiable, and after long journey only, you are going to deal that kind of emotional drives, and therefore for a beginner, you have to seek the refuge of the concentration. Just be concentrate, whatever may be pleasurable object, but don't try to deal with big emotions. And when and where mind become mindful and understand how to deal with the materiality, just like I try to understand, when and where you try to focus the attention on a materialistic object or matter or concrete, something like breath or something like the rising and falling of the abdomen, or something like the keeping the left leg and right leg, you will understand you are observing, coming to face to face with only already arisen mature objects. You never see the early part of the object. Only gross part you can understand. Imagine you can keep that gross part continuously, for example, each and every in-breath and out-breath, without a miss, if you can keep contact, because we are keeping the object face-to-face with. Object and the noting mind, noted object and the noting mind come face-to-face with. Each and every in-breath and out-breath, if you take the in-breath and out-breath as an example, you are sure. Maybe 10-15 cycles. And once that familiarity develop only, the Buddha recommend, Buddha ask to see from where does this breath comes, in-breath comes, out-breath comes. Then you can understand, even though you only touch the gross point, it is starting in a very subtle layer, subtle way, and then at view, it's becoming gross, ultimately disappearing. So that is how, in order to sharpen your mindfulness, see or recommend to see the arising part of the object. Still we are talking about the materiality. And once that is skill, that will say not only you see the object, but you see the beginning of the object. And now mind is very sharp. It is adverting with two dimension now. Not only the object, the arising part of the object. So once that is skillful, then Buddha recommend us to see the arising, middle and the end. Then only you can see the bell-shaped curve that is common for each and every materialistic object, whatever may be, maybe rising and falling, or in-breath and out-breath, or the left leg or right leg. Once that model is established, then you understand the everything happening in the same model. Once that model confirmed in thousand and one times, same model you can apply to that kind of emotions, that kind of immaterial thing. They also happen in the same bell-shaped curve. You come across, you met up with only the tip of the iceberg, not the beginning part. So therefore, you have to now associate mental part, and there also you have to understand, I call them by name once it is matured. And what about the happening? What about the arising part? So there you have to be diligent and you must not be negligent. As and when it arises, one day you can see they are not so powerful at the early phase. So unless otherwise you retrospect, come back to the source, once it is gross, very difficult to control. And if you know the art, how to catch emotions at the early phase, then you can nip it at the bud level. So therefore, emotional or non-materialistic things are not possible for a beginner, unless otherwise you have very skillful mindfulness and understand the pattern, how it works, then you can have the emotional intelligence. That is what now they put the term. Emotional intelligence you gain once you get the intelligence regarding the materiality. So therefore, till you develop certain amount of mindfulness, you have to surrender. You have to do away. You have to find escapism towards the high emotions or peak panic kind of thing. Once it is not a completely hopeless thing, when and where you come up to a certain amount of mindfulness, one day it will be a good exercise for you. Till that, just avoid. That is what, when we are starting in a meditation, in the meditation center, we forget about family affairs, we forget about the world politics, anything, and just keep our mind only with the simple task. And someone has to give food, someone has to give lodgings, and we are try to keep within till we get certain amount of momentum in the mindfulness with respect to materiality, and later, slowly, slowly, you will understand how to tackle mental part, and there also it you have to associate noble friends, you have to strive through, then only you can have a hope.
The next question is, what is the difference between concentration and insight meditation, and when should we practice each one? Do we need to learn concentration meditation first?
So that particular person, if he or she can express or give a count on how is the relationship with the primary object, with that practical part, I may try to separate it out. This is leading to concentration, these observations regarding related to concentration, these observations relevant to insight, like without giving his or her experience, first-hand experience, under-the-nose experience, my talking will be just theoretical. So I invite, for the sake of this discussion, please come out with your experience, at least in sitting meditation, at least with your primary object.
Sorry, which was the part you said to explain about?
If you have any vivid lucid experience pertaining to walking meditation or sitting meditation with the so-called the primary object, that information will help me to separate it out, if possible. This is concentrated, leading concentration, this is leading to insight light.
My understanding of the concentration part was
Concentration. Your experience with your primary object.
Like noticing the rising and falling of the abdomen.
Yeah. So whenever it is rising, how do you know it is not falling?
You notice the sensation in the body.
So where is the sensation? What is the sensation? What is the part of body you are talking about? That is the specification I wish to have.
Like in the abdomen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the kind of sensation? This is rising, not falling. This is falling, this rising. Like, what is the intrinsic? What is the personal? Then and there sensation, experience, touch. You feel one with rising and one with falling.
You notice like expanding and then touching against your clothing, or stretching and then going down.
Yeah. So that is that. So that indicates you at that time you are mindful about the particular movement with that kind of direct touch. How many in breath, how many risings and fallings you can continue undisturbed? How many cycles?
About 5.
Yeah. So then when it is happening, if you can continue further in 5 with your whole common sense and preparedness and everything, trial and error, you can increase little by little. You may see, more you observe, this is red palm of the left leg and right leg, you see the difference. This rising, this falling. And more you go there, you learn different shapes, different manners, different natural characteristics of two. That means that is called discriminated knowledge. More and more you go to that kind of a discrete understanding, this is rising, not falling. This is falling, not rising. It is more towards the insight meditation. But when you are doing in the Metta Bhavana or virtues of the Buddha, you just take it as a one thing and try to enter into that sensation, but not analytical, not discrete, not discriminative. And these are the early qualities or early signs of your tendency, but generally speaking, rising and falling right from the beginning, it's an insight meditation. There's no chance for concentration. If at all any concentration happen, it is called momentary concentration. That is related to from the inside meditation jargon vocabulary. But if you are doing anapana, it can lead both. Anapana is the only object of meditation Buddha prescribed. Bifolk way, some people go in the samatha way, concentration, some people go inside. That the way the person perceives gives symptoms. It is going to the concentration or inside. So therefore, unless otherwise you add, you give your direct experience, touch, very difficult someone to predict. Even you yourself can't. So therefore, you have to see the symptoms, experience or touch with that only happening. So as far as you are doing rising and falling, it is naturally starting with the inside. So no, when it is increasing 5 cycles to 6 cycles, 7 cycles, like whenever increasing, that means your tendency is for the vipassana or insight, and you have possibility to increase it. More number of cycles you can continue, it gather the momentum. At the beginning, it is just getting the pickup. Here and there you get it, again you mind wandering, again you apply it, again wandering, like you familiarize the situation. After a while you may see it is catching the momentum, you can have a longer time with your primary object. But anyway, whatever may be, the growth is on the inside way.
The next question is, do you prefer to be called Bhante or Swamin Vahansa?
Never mind, whatever may be. Bhante is a kind of the Western method. Swaminvansa is a Sri Lankan, a traditional method. So whatever it may be.
Next question. How can we use Buddhist principles to cope with sickness and death?
Buddhist principles are the only thing cope up with the sickness and the death. All the religions are trying to avoid it. And they are talking about the pleasurable side of the life. And only the Buddha talking about death as a sign of or object of meditation. So therefore many consider Buddhism as nihilistic, Buddhism as negative. It has kind of a religion looking at the negative side of the world. So therefore, always it is minority. Never it will become majority, because people are driven by pleasure principle. They know the death, they know the sickness, but they try to avoid. One day when I was traveling in Melbourne, there were very senior other the Buddhists were in the vehicle, and we were in the West Bank Bridge, and it's in the Yarra River, and it's not a straight bridge, it's curvature. And one person told, maybe the person who is driving, Bhante, this bridge is always under the surveillance, because people immediately stop the vehicle and jump into the river, committing suicide. And if it is happening, following day 15 will come and jump. So therefore, this information never broadcast, never published. They are not talking each other, because they suppress each and everything. So another person behind the seat, very elderly, he told, I appreciate that whenever the death or suicide happens, there is a kind of a wave, infectious wave, others also feel like trying it. So therefore our media never encourage it. So they appreciate it as a good side of the Western media. Then crossed my mind, I told, that is what Prince Siddhartha got from King Suddhodana. Suddhodana never exposed death to the young prince. He made the city free of all this sickness and death. He is not allowed to go beyond that. So therefore, he saw a happy world. That was the thing created Prince Siddha, the King Suddhodana, because he wanted his son to be the king. The lineage was there also a prediction or prophecy telling one day he will renounce. So therefore he made the city free of old age, sickness and death. And the day he got the Yuvaraja Tanaturo, or the appointed king, he got his authority, he got his executive powers, he went beyond the city limit, and then first thing he see, old age, sick, death, and then the renounced person. That was enough. He renounced. So that's exactly the Catholic world is doing. They say the God-created world is the paradise. There are no bad omens. They say all the sick people are put into the hospitals. All the mad people are put into the asylum. Elderly people put into the houses for elders. Only the young people with the pleasurable life you can see in the town. So we Sri Lankan, when we come here, what a heaven. Everything is there because all the bad omens are not there. So we appreciate their media. We appreciate, yes, the town without that elderly people, town without sick people, town without the mad people, town without the dead. They have created. So we are titillating ourselves and we try to avoid the truth. And I told that when your close family member dead, you are not allowed to take the carcass at home. It must be kept on the parlor. The reason is full of germs. And therefore, if you wish, you have to go to the parlor and then do the funeral, it's not allowed. Because they wanted to make this world created by God is happy. Otherwise, God can't have so much of a distance and the hierarchy. So you see the whole Roman Catholic law. You see the whole Roman Catholic education, political system. Medical system, everything is to create kind of a utopia or the heaven on earth. But after 200 years of their joke, but everyone is lunatic now. 40% frustrated. Sicknesses coming from hospitals. You don't know. Whole hospital they have to cover because germs are creating by the hospital because iatrogenic effect. Political situation is crushing you and killing the society, killing the atmosphere, global warming, no answer. They have so much. They are killing your moral shame and moral fear. Ultimately, children and the younger generation behave like beasts. With that kind of a camouflage, you can't maintain it. Now, after 200 years, now we are on the return journey in the pendulum. It went up to the far end of the technology. Now, it's when you are coming back, you have to understand the death. Whatever the way you try to camouflage and gloss over, whatever the sickness you are going to camouflage and gloss over, Buddha says you can't make one centimeter of advancement regarding these sansaric diseases, old age, sickness and death, and birth. Utter suffering. Whatever the way you try to hide it, whatever the health insurance you have, whatever the medical science you have, not a single change you can do. I remember in the debate society when I was a young boy, I took a part that technology can make better. That's the part I have to represent. So I am giving that operations and all the kind of thing. Everything is picked up knowledge. It's nothing original. And the other party was find the negative side of it. Always we are winning. We are scientists. We are promoting science. But whatever may be, it's a truth. So therefore, as far as you... who Panditas are doing back in Burma, he says, as far as you forget about death and old age, your attitude is for the entertainment. In a justifiable or injustifiable way. So therefore, you work, you behave like a person who is not going to die. Death is for the neighbor, not for me. That's a attitude we have. Otherwise, you can't entertain this world. When and where you remember the death again and again, you will live happily. You will not exploit others. You will not kill others. You will not rob others. You will sexually not abduct others. So such a way, if you live happily, death will be happy. But if you forget about them and try to have pleasure principle, death is such a desperate thing. So that is why people, towards the death, they are utterly desperate and it is too late. By that time it is too late. And they find the religion is a kind of a betrayal from you, from the happiness or entertainment. So therefore they try to keep that kind of a teaching and meditation as far away and try to entertain from morning to evening. Ultimately you are cheating yourself. It's a kind of a perversion. So don't try to sell this. Don't try to convince others. It's an utter failure. Only the wise people can understand, and even then it is painfully slow at the beginning. Therefore, the death and the old age, the Buddha took it as a reminder for the meditators, and whatever the way you try to push them away, it revert back in a very bad way. So therefore, best thing is to remember each and every. So that is why whenever you are to observe a materiality, you see the peak, you see the tip of the iceberg. But after long, long practice only, you can see the beginning and the middle. With that whole armed mind only ready to see the cessation. Cessation means the death. That is called Nirodha. And that can be possible. Otherwise, you get nauseatic. You feel mentally upset. You will send mad to see the cessation of the object. It's you consider as a bad omen. But once you meditate and convince your mind with your under-the-nose experience, everything arising is bound to pass away. And not only listening, not only contemplative and inferential, the time you see, that's the time you are ready to see the emotional. And emotions, almost negative. So cessation of an emotion is positive. Otherwise, emotions are always the same. But in the Western neuroscientist, when that is being presented, His Holiness Dalai Lama told, compassion is an emotion, it is not negative. That's the point he kicked the Western neuroscientist, and then Richard Davidson clicked his mind. He says, all the emotions are bad except compassion. Compassion is an emotion. It is positive. Then only he used the functional MRI scan to check emotion, in the sense compassion, how does it work in the meditator's mind. And that gave a huge opening. And he told that kind of revolutionary thinking came from His Holiness Dalai Lama. Otherwise, all the emotions are considered as bad. Seven destructive emotions they found after the World Trade Center destruction. But still they never studied about the compassion. So whenever compassion put into a machine and see, emotions also, there are some good things, but you can't tackle it unless otherwise you learn about the materiality.
The next question is, why do we usually take the five precepts when we have eight?
Why do
we usually take the five precepts when we have eight?
So it is not a plural question. You have to ask why I am taking. It is up to you. Why do we? That not plural sense. Buddha never put a commandment. If you wish, you may take. Otherwise, it is artificial. No one is pushing. So you can be civilized or barbaric. It is up to you. You can be morally shameable person or unshamed. It's up to you. There is no person have authority to tell you, take these precepts or not to take these precepts. This is the only religion. All the other things, they have pushed you. If you are such believer, you have to have this and that. So therefore, don't take it as a imprisonment. Precept is not an imprisonment. You can do away with anything. Not only 8 precepts, not only 5 precepts, but you know, if you are to undergo a surgery, and if you are going to take to the theater, you have to undergo certain disciplinary rules for your infectious, for your germs. So you say that I need operation, I can't go into the theater, why don't you do it in the kitchen or in the toilet? They are what you call etiquettes. So likewise, when you come to the meditation, it says 8 precepts, 5 precepts, 9 precepts, 10 precepts. It is a convention. You are convening, you are convention. Do it, but don't take it as a burden. That means you have not got the basic idea of restraint. Restraint is self-imposed. The Buddha is not a commander, not regimentation. So that misunderstanding keep a lot of young people from exploring into the precepts or moral restraint, because many people try to impose and creating unwanted negative feeling towards the Buddhism as well as the moral restraint. But if you wish to be a civilized person, be a gentleman, cultured person, you have to go by etiquettes. No other way. So likewise, that if you wish to have the concentration training, restraint, you have to have the moral restraint, maybe 5. And Venerable Mahasi Sayado, presenting this, he says, if you read whole Tipitaka, there's not a single place the Buddha has mentioned you must have precepts, and so much after time only you can start meditation. He says there's no time gap. Same moment you can be a restraint on morality as well as wisdom or meditation. So therefore, after taking precepts, there's no seasoning time. There's no maturity happens. Immediately both can happen. So that is how Angulimala and the Bhattacharya, like cases, they have no incident of precepts. Immediately Dhamma introduced, they understood. So therefore, don't take it as a barrier or a barricade. That means because of your wrong understanding about the precepts, it's called Silabbata Paramasa, and that will be get rid of only at the Sotapanna level. Till that, everyone is misunderstanding about this. There's a misunderstanding about the precepts, and that will be out once you achieve the first path.
The next question is, what is the purpose of meditation?
So if someone, just like precepts, why do you meditate? What make you to meditate? Don't tell anyone to meditate. If you know it, you will never tell. Because people love it, the pleasure principle. For them, meditation is a imprisonment, a punishment, or regimentation. So you will be a disciplinarian. So therefore, meditation is no use. If you are happy here and now, without meditation, well and good. But if you are not happy, then you may be searching. So Dhatta Chato Upasankamati, the Buddha mentioned, when and where you are stuck with the unbearable suffering, then only the faith arises. Then only you go in search. Till that, you find, I am well and good. So much so, you will never be a seeker. You will never be a devoted person. So the day the unbearable suffering comes and stuck you, then there is no other way. The faith happens. Then you go in search. And then this question will not be valid. Till that it is valid, because the particular person writing this question with the mentality, someone would have imposed upon him or her, do meditate, then this question valid. So more and more I meditate, I have my fear to recommend meditation for anyone. It is misleading people. When someone comes, then my duty to share with. But I never ask someone to meditate, because he or she has to be mature enough. So simply put, I would say, to meditate, you must have your past merits. Otherwise, you will never. To have that attitude, you must have so much of pubbeja kata punyata. The merits at hand, so they only see what is called urgency or sangvega. Other may find my elder brother is completely vehemently against Buddhism. He is an utter communist. And when I try to renounce, my father was not there, so I went to him and told on behalf of, instead of my father, I am telling, no, don't tell me. If you go and meditate, you will get enlightened, not me. Don't ask me. It is nonsense. It is idealistic. How can you live without money nowadays? It's a dream. Then I told, you have your dream to have your wife. So you got it. I have my dream to have my wife. That is monkhood. I will get it. So he can't understand to the last minute. What to do? It is none of my business. And that lesson taught to me by him, he says, don't fork in the fingers others, this thing. This is none of our business. He said, I mean, us come and help, but don't philosophize. Don't tell people to do this and that. It's a hell of a responsibility. So otherwise that you are degrading meditation by giving it to unqualified people. You are degrading meditation by giving in to unqualified people. That is what happened. That is what's happening in the Buddhism at large in Sri Lanka. They are doing for the experimental basis. Don't do that bloody fool thing. Meditation is a high tension wire. Not 230. Not 33,000. It is 166,000. If you touch it in a wrong way, funeral is already happening. Nothing to do any the incinerator or nothing. So therefore, if you handle it, do it with the gloves, do it with both the hands, and therefore let that be high up in there, high tension wire. Don't play with it. So I feel more and more the consequences of the bad consequences of wrongly tackle meditation. It's the easiest way to become lunatic. Shortcut to become lunatic.
The next question is, I feel sleepy when I do the sitting meditation with my eyes closed. Is it okay to keep eyes open and focus on an object instead? For example, the statue of the Lord Buddha. Or focus on the breath while keeping eyes open?
They are also valid methods, but the sleepiness may be a result of meditation. That's a furtherance of the boredom, the furtherance of the monotony, furtherance of lack of interest. So therefore, sleepiness never come all of a sudden. So that's why I ask her, when is the sleepiness sets in? Before sleepiness, this boredom happens, or monotony happens, or all these are valid episode or healthy episodes in the meditation. To put it in this way, when and where the sensuous desire and the hatred reduces in our mind, then the ignorance appears. It appears like boredom. It appears like sleepiness. So when the meditation or mindfulness is tackling your prominent two defilements, like desire and hatred, the appearance of ignorance is a result of meditation. So therefore, go prepared for the sleepiness and see to tackle it without the image of the Buddha, without opening your eyes. And that is the simple tactic is, go prepared. That preparedness you do with respect to your primary object. Before sleepiness, is there any vivid, lucid, diligent confrontation with the primary object. Under such circumstances, see as much as possible shapes, manner, natural characteristic of the primary object, then your mind become diligent, mind become mobilized, mind become energized, and that means that you are not succumb to the sleepiness. So therefore, when and where face to face with the object, don't be lethargic, don't be get a distance of the object, go more immediate with the object and see object in detail. Ultimately, you feel kind of a catalytic effect, the mobilizing energy, and that will answer the forthcoming sleepiness. So next time, try your best to keep the primary object in view with, expect after a while, boredom, monotony, sleepiness, doubtfulness, and consider this as an endowment of meditation or mindfulness, then sleepiness will not do harm. It will be a sign. It will be a signpost. Now, Kamachanda Vyapada, sensuous desire and the hatred is somewhat tackled. And now, sleepiness can come in. Early two defilements or hindrances reduce. Now you are with the third one. So therefore, the same technique, same mindfulness, same closed eye, same primary object, but go prepared. It is, of course, advice for advanced yogis, or otherwise we have to put this way. If you are a regular yogi, regular practitioner, the preparedness will be a lasting answer. If you are doing meditation in a haphazard way, not in a regular way, then you have to find other rough methods like opening eyes and looking at the image of the Buddha, or recitation, or walking meditation, that kind of active alternatives you have to search.
The next question is, why do we go to the temple and why do we worship the pagoda?
Not necessary. I have never asked anyone to go there, so I am not a person to answer. I have never contributed for any pagoda. I have never put up any temple. I don't know how it happens. So anyone goes, I have no any against idea. Anyone not going, still I don't have. Because it is not important. But simply put, if you wish to be mindful, the Buddha recommend go to the forest or to under a tree or to a silent place. Instead of the silent place, solitude place, the temple came into being. So therefore people, instead of going into a forest or instead of going under a tree, they are happy to put up buildings, happy to put up temples. This is last option. And ultimately that became Buddhism, against the church, against the kovila. And now we are fighting each other, putting up temples. But the Buddha says, go under a tree. Go to the forest. It's a much better option. But the thing is, sensuous being, to people with the sensuous gratification, they fear forest. They feel happy to go to a solitude place in terms of temple. So therefore, that temples, they were not there in the early Buddhist ideas. After 20 years only, Buddha accepted assigned forest and temples and putting up Pirivena. Pura Buddha Sasana, that means in the first 20 years, the Buddha never accepted it. It is the way institutionalization happened. So this question is against institutionalization. It's a possible way. Not necessary, it is not a must. But I would recommend seek solitude. Seek a solitude place, otherwise you are burning your candle from both the ends. So going to a solitude place is it's something healthy. That means you have your own confidence, I can live by myself. If you do not have it, you are always depending on someone, or institute. So that means your personality has not built up and you are not independent. You don't know what does it mean by sovereignty. You do not know what does it mean by contentment. So much so you go for the institute. So institute has, it has its own role. But later you must be independent from them when and where you gain the momentum in mindfulness. You go away from time and space. Otherwise, you are bonded to the space and time. This is question is pertaining to space.
Pante, the last written question is, what does meditating and being mindful do to the body?
It is now, earlier it was mental game. Now it says even not only the bodily cell, not only the chromosome, not only the RNA, DNA. At the end of the RNA, DNA, there's a cap. And it is exhausting so quickly whenever you are in a tension, whenever you are in the frustration. But when and where you become solitude, that cap is growing again. That means longevity. So therefore now they have measured the kind of brain waves emitting and the effect of meditation to your chromosome life, even 1 hour sitting, even 1 hour mindfulness. Now they have developed techniques, and Richard Davidson presented them to in Mind and Life conference to His Holiness Dalai Lama. He says, if you love yourself, develop mindfulness. Or if you are indulging yourself, expect a quick death, heart attack. So cholesterol, tension, frustration, panic. So it is up to you. That is burning the candle from both the ends and you are waste away, while away your life. And otherwise, solitude and be unto yourself, be here and now. It has one-to-one relationship. And presently, specifically the American, German and Australian, maybe some Malaysian experience, they see the relationship between the physical health, that means secular methods, secular benefits of the mindfulness. And therefore, it says, train your mind and change your brain. If you train your mind, you can change your brain circuits. Otherwise, people thought brain circuit get confirmed, hardwired after the age of six. Now, after meditation, they introduce neuroplasticity. Even your brain wiring or neurobics can be changed, so you can see another person within yourself, another personality traits within yourself, another likings and disliking, rather than your stereotype method. So this is how it is changing the brain. And some other people put, just like the brain for your head, your body, each and every cell carrying its own nucleus, each and every cell carries its own RNA, DNA, each and every RNA, DNA work like a brain. So therefore, it is not confined to your brain, not confined to your nervous system. Each and every cell relax. Every cell get mobilized. So when and where you stop your volitional activities, willful activities, and let everything happen and fully vigilant, as if you practice in sitting meditation, don't move your body, don't talk, and try to be aware. That's the way each and every cell get relaxed. And in the sleeping it may happen, but you are not aware. But here the vigilance is there, diligence is there. Then you are doing it a very purposeful way, and that is the only compassion you do to your body. So therefore in Chanki Sutta, Buddha mentioned, Kayena Cheva Parama Satchan Satchi Karoti. After a certain amount of momentum in the meditation, you feel relaxation. You feel cell by cell, each and every nook and corner, you feel relaxed. And you find that happens only when everything happens automatically, when everything happens unintentionally, when everything happens when there is no will. So, the opposite of it, Arthur Schopenhauer extract it from the Western point of view, each will is evil. Anything you have, any volitional activities, is against your health. So it make a big change in the Western psychology, considers him as a nihilistic and negative. But his follower, Nietzsche, still maintain it and say, anything you do with intention, anything you do with will, something abnormal. So best thing you can do for your benefit is, let the thing happen. And observe vigilantly, even for 5 minutes, you can see how much your body is relaxing and therefore it is physical.
Vanthi, can you please explain the concept of selflessness or anatta and how meditation can help us with understanding that?
So if you can define atta, I may get ammunition.
The three truths of Buddhism, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and then there's selflessness, the fact that there's no soul or self as such. So I particularly like to understand that last one, you know, the concept of there being no self or soul as such, and how meditation and mindfulness can assist us with really understanding that. And
so we'll put it like that. We'll have a null hypothesis, there is atta. And your whole meditation is to disprove it. In putting it to scientific projects, you write your null hypothesis. There is atta. That body is atta. The feelings is atta. Perception is atta. My volitional activity is atta. My mind is atta. You write 5 projects. And disprove one by one. First you have to have null hypothesis. There is atta. Buddha is there who painting a picture to give you atta. So Buddhism, they hate atta. No. Read Pottapada Sutta, Buddha is painting 3 kinds of atta. Olari kattapatilava, rupi attapatilava, manome attapatilava. Olari kattapatilava, manome attapatilava, sanyame attapatilava. He says people recognize the body as atta. Take the body and see what is the essence. And then take the feelings as atta. Let the feelings arise, you see it is disappearing without any remainder. And perception, and volitional, and the mind. So take one by one, but you have to go in sequential order. Start with materiality. So therefore, first accept the null hypothesis, there is atta. Read it and define it and solidify it, concrete it. And then take one by one and observe, is there any evidences, verifiable evidence, to say the materiality is atta or the body is atta. So one by one. So you have to put the question in the pragmatic way. The anatta is you are hitting against the air. Nothing there. If there is something, it will hit. If there is nothing, you are the one getting tired. So you have to see with your whole common sense, what is it worth calling atta? First you have to find your enemy. Otherwise, how can you find the war strategies? So Buddha gave 5 clues. Take rupa as atta, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana. And some people, they are specialized. Some people are rupa. That's only at the 20s and 30s you consider the body as atta. 40s and 50s, the feelings. And ultimately it goes back. When you become old age, you try last and then get defeated and die so that you will get another life. Try again. So each time we do, but the meditator, what you do is, like person like you, define your atta for your experiment, for you with your wordings, with your experience. that elimination procedure is very scientific. The Buddha was the first one to give it. That's called Vibhajyavada. Cut into pieces and take one by one. Because you don't have enough potential energy organized. You have speed but no volume, no velocity. Velocity is a directed speed. So develop little bit of velocity to define little thing and then get the information, get the base and means, get the confidence and go to the next thing and do the same. And when you continue, where you define your atta, you will be destroyed. First and foremost, you have to define, or you have to have a spying about your enemy's strength. Otherwise, you can't have war strategy. Whatever the energy you have, it's utter waste. So you have to spy. The spying is maybe sometimes 50% of your warfare. You have to understand how much the enemy is strong. So while you are spying, you are not with uniform. You do spying as with civil costumes and go and see how much it is strong. Accordingly only you do warfare. So this one Buddha has mentioned the drone very nicely, and therefore the Sinhalese Buddhist, they start telling no atta. So that means they are in a lost game. You have to define atta first. You understand? I have my own desire. I have my own hatred. I have my own sleepiness. I have my own doubts. I have my own past and future. No one can deny. It is not unethical to accept that I have my own desire. And get that desire, see, under the light of my mindfulness, under the microscope, and whatever the department you take, exactly the same thing, it is holographic presentation. So take one part, but beforehand you have to write the null hypothesis. Your objective, your project, defined it. And the day you get the unbearable suffering, there you find the guy. If you consider this suffering is me, mine and myself. Imagine unpredictable, unforeseen suffering happen. You consider this as me, this as mine, this as myself. And if you have no tools by that time, double lost. Worst. But if you have tools, you can understand your bloody idiotness, consider this as me. It is something worse, something happening to you, the cause and effect. When you take it as me, it's mine and myself, and you are the person to suffer. But if you have the tools to say, it is there, but it is not me, it is not mine, it is not myself, just like your breath, just like your feeling, then any destruction or any unforeseen situation, there is a fair amount of handling of that situation. But many are not ready. Many never think about beforehand. So ultimately when the mishap happens, it's too late. Imagine a young person going and do meditate and earn their tools. What a lucky person. When the mishap happens, he or she is having tools now. So it is very capitalistic system. Meditation is an utter capitalistic system. Those who have, better off. Other people, no mercy. And don't try to save them because we have no powers. We only can say, please take your own time, please be mindful. But if they are not accepting that the person I mentioned, that Richard Davidson, he's one of the brilliant person, and he says he is meditating, he's being an American top class scientist 40 years regularly. He says, now I know for the whole problems, mental and physical, mindfulness is the answer. It is free of charge. And see how many of you are willing to practice it? No. They will go for medicine. They will go for legal opinion. They will go for banks. They will go for political parties. They will go for social things. No one take mindfulness. He says, I can't imagine I can't even design an experiment as to see why people are not meditating, being it is so free. It's such a mad world. So therefore, only you can do is be happy with the little bit of people, those who are meditating. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. Our Lukavutra used to say, be happy anyone if he is abiding by moral precepts, abiding by concentration, abiding by wisdom, and be sympathetically joyful. That's the only positive thing on the earth. Being everything free, why people are not meditating? You can't comprehend it. Because they don't understand this Atta concept and Anatta concept. They stop at conceptual level, inferential level. They never invest for the ways and means. So therefore, when the mishaps strike, or when the unforeseen happens, it's too late. So therefore, to answer your question, define your Atta. Or otherwise, if you have chance, read Pottapada Sutta. Two occasions, this problem is appearing. And Buddha is asking, whenever the Pottapada is defining his way of Atta, then Buddha says, I am sorry, that definition won't give any practical hint. Likewise, don't hate Atta, love Atta, create Atta, define Atta, and try to prove it, then you will be the loser. The loser means you understand Anatta. I don't know whether I am leading you or misleading you.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah.
Okay, 10 more minutes. If you have any other questions to raise in the audience. Otherwise, we'll take it for walking meditation.
Bhante, maybe since we have 10 more minutes left, maybe you could also talk about the other two concepts as well and the application of mindfulness and meditation to that. So that's the concepts of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness.
So impermanence is already proven fact in physics. E is equal to mc square. Energy and the matter. Energy can be matter, matter can be energy, so they are not permanent. Till Einstein was coming out with this one, the religious circle understood at a time matter arises, so collapsing happens, at a time they become energy. Energy means immaterial, it's not a matter. And from energy, quantum energy behavior, and sometimes they collapse into matter. So it is nothing religious. And suffering, still nothing. That is no contribution from the Buddha to the anicca dukkha. It was there beforehand, Hinduism utterly understood. But they understood it is due to Brahma. Brahma is soul. Brahma is responsible for this matter to energy and energy to matter relationship. But they are Buddha, so yes, there is one, but it is impersonal. It's a universal law, it's a mind law, chitta niyama, not a Brahma. But still, after the vipassana introduced, even now Hindus accept the Buddha gave the lasting answer, but still they try to incorporate through that energy is Brahma. So they find that putting that the omnipotent, omnipresent energy as impersonal is not done according to them. It is a personal. It is a personification must be there. That is Brahma. That's the omnipotent, omnipresent God, and that is the point they misunderstood. But I can't understand. What is the greatness of putting them into impersonal, but that is the unique nature of the Buddhist teaching. The creating power is impersonal, or depersonalize God is the Four Noble Truths. Whenever personalized, there is Brahma. That's a omnipotent, omnipresent God. So that difference, very difficult to comprehend, very difficult to think about. And recently I read an article that Bhikkhu Bodhi is mentioning that many Buddhists do not understand it. They say that the omnipotent, omnipresent source, the element, never mind it may be a Brahma, never mind it may be God. Or Buddha says it is no person. So that is the point, that is the contribution, the new thing or novelty the Buddha contributed. So therefore anicca and dukkha is nothing special. So if you read Mahavira books, or Mahavira means Nigantanatha Buddha, all suttas available, they utterly accept anicca and dukkha. But anatta part, they get confused. They can't have a clear-cut explanation like in Buddhism. But even the Buddhism, it is, they are Buddhists. They are not up to comprehension that. They claim we are anatta, we are all the kind of things, just utter superficial. And they can't verify it. Because unless otherwise you become mature in anicca dukkha, you are not qualified to go to anatta. Without dealing, without qualifying, without armed with that kind of thing, if you go there, it is just inferential knowledge. It is just argumenting, or it is deductive knowledge. So Buddha gave not much of value for deducing deductive knowledge. Deductive knowledge is necessary to a certain extent, but you must have utter or thorough understanding of the anicca dukkha. Then you are qualified to go into the question of that basic element is with soul or personalized or not. That's a point we are talking about. Okay, if there are no other questions, now almost time up. We'll take time for 1 hour. For sitting meditation, and we'll be meeting here at 4:30 for another 2:30, 3:30 walking meditation. 3:30 we will be meeting here for another group sitting session. Thank you very much for the participation.